My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to this podcast, Neue Musik lieben. This is, in general, a German podcast about contemporary music and, inside knowledge about musicians and music making. But once in a while, or maybe more often, I do some episodes and interviews in English. This actually is my 9th interview in English, and I will come to that in a minute. I have studied classical singing and music, but I love to sing contemporary music, and I do that a lot. And if you would like to find more about me, and you would like to meet me or hear me sing on the internet or live, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this in the show notes for you. There you also have the option to subscribe my newsletter, which you will get about once a month, where I tell you where I'm singing and what this podcast is doing and what episodes will come up. In this podcast, I will talk with you on themes all around music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge. And I want you to bring the human beings out of the new music world closer to you. And I say thank you to all of you who have written to me in the past and given me feedback for my podcast. This is very, very touching for me, and it also motivates me to keep going with this podcast. I also like to mention, and I'm very proud, that I'm cooperating with the newspaper NMZ called Neue Musikzeitung, which is one of the biggest German music papers in Germany. And I will put the link to NMZ into the show notes for you. Today I have a very interesting interview for you with the music theater director Nina Braser. She comes from Great Britain or Wales, but now she has been living and working for a while in Germany, lately at the opera in Frankfurt. And I think she tells you great things about how to direct an opera, what the differences are between directing whatever, a Mozart opera or a contemporary opera, and also how it is to be a female director. And she also gives you very, very good advice how to actually, get a directing job in Germany if you're from a different country, like she is. So please enjoy the interview with Nina Braser. Hello, Nina Braser. I'm welcoming you here to Düsseldorf, and I'm so happy that you're here to do this interview with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. Let's dive right into it and start with the question, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
I was actually very young and very early in my career, and it was the first assisting job in opera that I'd done, and also the first opera I'd ever seen. It was a new contemporary piece in that we'd rehearsed in London by a British composer called Paul Clark. It was directed by John Wright of, he has a company called Told by an Idiot, which is a very mime-based company, and they're wonderful. And I was brought on as the assistant director. I had never worked in opera before. I'd been only working in the theatre at the time. And that was my very first opera that I experienced. And I went, sort of dived straight in the deep end and assisted this performance. It was called Arcane, and we went down to the Sherman Theatre in Cardiff and then eventually went to the studio at Sadler's Wells. And it was just like a complete different world for me, because I was brought up in Wales, and we have a lot of music in our lives in Wales. You're always singing in choruses and singing in assembly, and they're singing at least 3 times a day, and there's competitions and what we call Eisteddfods every single year. So there's music is really a way of life. But I this sort of opera and this sort of new music was something that was completely new to me. And that was my first experience coming in as an assistant director. And, my mind was just blown.
And since then you did a lot of contemporary music theatre, I assume.
Yes, I've done a really big mixture, so it's always been a combination of the classic, but there's mm-hmm. always been contemporary work in there. I tended to end up always meeting composers and really getting on very well with them and working very collaboratively. So I worked with a composer, and he's also a conductor as well, Tim Burke, and we met at the Royal Opera House in London, where I was observing on a show at the time. That was my sort of introduction to the Royal Opera House in London, and it turned out he was a composer, and we sort of got talking, and then we ended up entering a festival in London of new music, and so we did a double bill of Trouble in Tahiti, and then he wrote a new piece called Spilt Milk, and we've decided that they were, you know, the perfect partners to present at this festival, and that we decided that, you know, the audiences would be interested to come and see Trouble in Tahiti, but then would also be really excited by the new piece, and it just tended to work year by year. Something always came in, and often someone who'd seen my work the year before, or a composer who'd seen my work perhaps the year before at a festival, asked me then to do something the following year. So over the years that kind of built up. So I've worked recently with he's actually a tenor as well, and a composer called Tom Randall, and he wrote a wonderful piece called A Telephone Call, based on the piece by Dorothy Parker, and we presented that in London at the Tête-à-Tête Opera Festival. And then again another a contemporary music group then saw this piece of work, and then they contacted me about devising a piece of new music, and this was going to be based on Shakespeare's Winter's Tale. And then we devised with five actors and four musicians, so a harpist, a double bass, a clarinetist and a soprano, and we devised together this sort of completely new way of making music with text and with these musicians, and it was an extraordinary time. And we worked together at Snape Maltings, who did a residency there, and then at the end we had this sort of hour-long reduced version of Winter's Tale that we then presented.
And when you prepare yourself for such an opera, is there for you a difference preparing like The Magic of Figaro, which you also have directed already, or a piece of contemporary music?
I think sometimes it's much harder with contemporary music because you don't have that real soundscape in mm-hmm. your mind of what it's going to sound like. So the piece that I directed most recently was Alex Mills's Dear Mary Stopes, and it was he'd scored it for viola da gamba, cello, electronics and percussion, and I have this score in front of me, but I can't picture what this is going to sound like. So of course you have the text, I had the text as a basis to go on. But in a way it's very, very different, and you know, maybe you'll have a version from the composer, a piano mm-hmm. version or something, and that can really help in terms of, you know, where it's going melodically.
So you have to be like very spontaneously when you all come together and you finally hear the music.
Yeah, because it can be a total surprise, you know. Okay. I didn't know what Viola da Gamba with electronics was going to sound like. I couldn't, you know.
It sounds like an interesting combination.
It was an amazing combination. Yeah. I really only heard it for the first time when the musicians uh-huh. were in the room, and thankfully they came very early in the process when we were working on that piece, which was first last summer and then most recently in London. So yes, I think you prepare in a very different way. You have to be almost a lot more open. Like I think with something like Figaro, you have to have, you know, it's such a long, solid piece. You have to have a real structure and a real plan and exactly how it's going to work, and entrances and exits and interaction, and have everything sort of planned down to the very last detail. But I think with something new, as you know, hopefully you've got enough time to rehearse it, and of course you need the visuals to be clear and what you want, how you want it perhaps to look like and what you want the world to feel like, but then of course to be open to what these new sounds and
but are you maybe with the contemporary music even more free, but because with the Figaro you will be always compared to other Figaros.
Yes,
I mean, there
true.
Have been so many good ones already out there.
Yeah, it's true. I think, yes, in a way you are completely free. I mean, I found often working with composers, with contemporary composers, that they often have a very clear visual mm-hmm, idea mm-hmm. as well.
Yes.
So in some ways you're very open, but I think it's also, from my side, I'm a very big collaborator, and I find that you have to also except that they will have something, often something very clear in mind for how it's going to look or feel. And I think for me, I would always try to take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. Like there's no point being like in a battle with your composer.
Yeah.
Like it has to all work together. So in some ways you're completely wide open and free, and you can make suggestions with everything. And of course it's always a collaboration, you know, with the set designer and the costume designer. But in this instance, you've got a composer there as well. And I think of them also as being a sort of intrinsic element of that sort of imagination of the piece. So yes, in a way you're free, but you have perhaps another member of the artistic creative team to also be answerable to in a way. Yes.
I think it's great that you say that you really cooperate with a composer as well, because I also heard that a lot, that they often have a very specific idea, and sometimes when the director doesn't react to it, they're kind of also very disappointed.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the main goal probably would really be to collaborate and figure out what would suit both or really make the a great result. You already mentioned it, that you also like cooperation. That makes, I like that personally a lot too, but I also know a lot of directors who maybe whatever, more the old generation, that think more in hierarchy, and whatever the director says, that's the only important word. For you it's different, or do you think it's changing already in this world that people really collaborate more, or where are we going?
Do you know, that's a really, really interesting question. I think often in a standard opera house there is always going to be a hierarchy, because you'll have the director and you'll have the assistant directors, and there will also be the people being answerable to the director, and I think that will always be a question. I think in the more experimental world, what I have found is it's often a much more collaborative process. So I think in the old school world of where, for instance, I'm working at Opera Frankfurt, you would expect to have that hierarchy, and the director would always expect that you know the assistants would defer to them. But I think in the experimental world, what I found is I enjoy working as a collaborator in that way, and it's always, for me, always made the work stronger. And I think, you know, if for instance sometimes with a composer you might have a different opinion about how something's presented and they have an idea, what you have to do is have a better idea and sell it to them. And if you can't, well, there's a reason for that, and there's a reason they have a visual in their mind and when they were composing that they felt that something should be presented in that way. So you have to, I think, really work hard to see someone else's point of view and to either encapsulate that or give them a better idea, present them with something that's really going to win them over and say, oh, actually, I was thinking of it like this. And then you have to, you know, you have to persuade them and bring them around. So I think it's different. I think in the classic houses, the feeling, I mean, often there are new things that, you know, people are bringing in associate directors and revival directors. Of course, we have a sort of sense of collaboration. And I work very collaboratively with everyone I work with, you know, even with singers when I'm directing a revival, making sure that they have their own voices into the process and they feel like they're able to embody the role in the way that they would have done if they'd been doing the production for the first time. So I think my instinct is a collaborator, but then you always have to have the strength at the end of the day to say, this is going to be the way we're going to do it, you know, not to just always be open and, oh yes, let's do everyone's ideas, and because otherwise there's too many ideas perhaps swimming around. So I think to be able to be open to it, but then to be able to be firm enough to really bed it down and to make sure that the best ideas come to the top and that they're the ones that end up in the piece at the end of the day. So I think there's a mixture. I think there's a mixture, but it's a fantastic question.
Yeah, you have to be very flexible
to
react to everything. What are the qualities you most appreciate in the performers you work with?
I think imagination always, and adaptability, and being able to respond and be on the ball and respond differently if someone presents you with a different performance, to be able to respond to that naturally and not to be thrown by that. I think it's what I find hard and is if someone's incredibly rigid in the way they work, and then they can't be flexible in the way that they perform, because every performance is different. So I think, so for me, it's having a flexibility and an openness and an ability to respond to other singers, and also to take on new ideas and to bring new ideas to it. I mean, it can be very satisfying to work with a singer who does everything right and they do exactly as you say, but you also, of course, want them to bring their own life into it and breathe into the role themselves. So that for me, I think, is important. It's just such a gift when you and someone presents their idea of a role, or what, you know, where they feel the role is going, and you can always build on that or suggest it goes in a completely another direction. And if, you know, just that people are open and can take those ideas, I think is that's priceless.
Great. So when you do the contemporary productions, how do your friends, family, colleagues and audience react to that sort of music, and how do you deal with their reactions?
Oh, that's another good question. I mean, I've done some very quirky pieces, I suppose, in my time, and they've had really, really mixed responses. You know, I have an uncle who's himself a music producer, a pop producer, and he just will not see anything operatic at all. Mm-hmm. He says he won't come and see anything with these screechy voices, is how he puts it. So there are some families, who would just opt out of it and just, it's not for me. Okay. And they'll come and see a spoken word piece I do or a theatre piece that I do. On the other side, people can be incredibly open. You know, I mean, I think it's hard because your friends and your family, of course, are your biggest fans. So they can always find something positive to say. And I've been very lucky. So if, I don't know, maybe they say different things behind my back, but maybe I've just got away with it lightly. So far, my friends and family have been my biggest fan club. But I don't know what they say behind closed doors. So
I'm sure they're still your fans.
I hope so. Trying to think of the more obscure things I've done. You know, the thing that was quite risky for me was this collaboration I was mentioning with the five actors and the four musicians, and they're wonderful musicians, called the Hermes Experiment. And it was partly improvised and partly set, and the text was set. So I reduced the text from Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. And that was, for me, that was incredibly new, because they'd seen a production the year before, and they'd come to me and asked me to do it, and they'd asked me to devise it. And I couldn't really remember what devising was. It had been a long time since I'd been at university, and I think we'd done a module on devising, or maybe I even had at school when I was doing my A-level, we'd done something on devising. And I was like, I don't actually remember what devising actually is. And I sort of looked on my theatre bookshelves and found this like devising handbook that was clearly meant for, you know, 18-year-olds or something. And I was like, okay, then let's look into what this is. And this piece, I think, was a real experiment. It was a huge experiment for all of us. It was the first piece of theatre that they'd done as a group of musicians. It was the first piece like this that I'd done with five actors and four musicians and putting them together. And it sort of became this amalgamation of text and music and solos and monologues and completely integrated. And I think that was probably the thing that I was most curious about, what people's reactions would be. And sort of almost in a way controversially, we presented it at an opera festival in London, a tête-à-tête, the Contemporary Opera Festival in London, which is an excellent festival. And I sort of felt a bit fraudulent, because really it wasn't an opera. You know, there was not one singer in it. It was these four musicians, and it was five actors, and it was text, and there was rhythm, and there was music, and there was... So I think I was quite nervous about being sort of outed for being a fraud in an opera festival. Although, you know, the festival's incredibly open and incredibly experimental, so I'm sure they wouldn't have judged it. But I guess I worried in a way about the press and how they would take it. They would be like, well, it's all very well, but it's not an opera, you know. So that was the thing that I was most nervous about, and was one of the things that I guess in the end was actually the most successful, and that threw up the most interesting of responses from friends, from family, from critics, from everyone. Great. So it was kind of, you know, a bit of a, you know, baptism of fire of kind of learning how to relearning how to devise, discovering how to devise, you know.
Taking the risk,
you know, having no idea what people would think of it, and then just, you know, putting it out there and hoping for the best. And we were lucky to get a very positive response.
Super, super. Do you think there is prejudice against new music? And if so, how do you want to see things change? Or what are you doing to help bring about a change in the attitudes?
I think there is in the classical music world. I'm sure there is an audience that is prejudiced against new music because they like to go to the opera house and see their traditional pieces, and perhaps these are just things that they just don't come across, they don't come into their lives, they have their abonnement and they go to the opera, so maybe it's just not something that enters into their world. I think what we need to do is that bigger houses need to take on a role in developing new music and in creating music, new music, whether that's, you know, of course, perhaps in the first instance in the smaller spaces and perhaps in the foyers and in the world around their normal operatic sort of repertoire. But I think as opera houses, we have a responsibility, they have a responsibility to bring the thread of new music. I think everyone should be doing that. So I think For me personally, I've always had contemporary music in my life since my adult working life, I suppose. So my way is just to continue to create new operatic pieces, new music pieces. So just to continue and making sure that people enjoy these pieces and have access to these pieces. But I think it needs to be brought about on a bigger scale, and that's to bring in houses that have perhaps those audiences that perhaps they don't actually know they would be interested in these new pieces. So to bring it under, within the umbrella of a house, within the umbrella of the safe space where people come and have their abonnement, that perhaps they go to the studio space or even the main stage, even better, you know, do a contemporary opera on the main stage would be, you know, an exceptional idea. It's just the risks. I know it's the risks financially, of course, it's very difficult. But I think only that way can you introduce a more, let's say, inverted commas, traditional audience to something that's perhaps more alternative. So I think it's a responsibility to every house to bring in a thread of new music in whichever ways they can, in whichever ways they can introduce people to it. So I think the responsibility lies with all of us as individuals or as freelancers, and also with the people running the houses. I think of myself as working within a house that I would try to campaign for that.
Mm. You're from Wales.
It's true.
And you lived for a long time in London, but now you live in Frankfurt, and you actually, have a great position now in Germany. How is it to come to Germany to get work here as a director, and what would you suggest other young directors who maybe want to do the same?
It's tough. I would say the German language is incredibly difficult. You notice I'm not speaking it today. So I would say first learn the language. That is your big stepping stone in. That's the first and absolutely the most important thing, because without the language, there's a huge barrier, not only talking with administration, with creative teams, if you're going to come in and assist someone. So I would say that's the very first step. And you can do that in London, you can do that in a Goethe Institute around the world, everywhere. You can do it online, you can do it with Duolingo. There are no barriers to learning a language. There's a lot of practice involved. So I would say the language is the first step. I would say you can always write to a house and ask to be what we would call an observer in the UK, which is what I did when I came to Germany. I was a hospitantin, the equivalent of an observer. And I did that first in Opera Frankfurt three and a half years ago. And that's definitely an excellent introduction to a company, because you can work, you can observe, you can see how the team works, you can learn, you can develop your language skills while you're there. So of course, I guess I can only give the tips that I had. I'm sure
certainly,
there are much better ways.
You became successful, so tips are good.
So I would say the language is the first barrier, so overcome that, or start overcoming that as quickly as you can. And the second instance, and you know, if not every opera house will advertise a job as a hospitant or a hospitantin, you look at your own schedule, look at the time that you're available, see what which house you'd like to go to, what their schedule is, which opera you're most interested in, which director you want to observe, write to the person, you can find access to their email online, find the right person to write to, and ask them if they would be open to having an observer. I think that's definitely a way in. The house gets to meet you, and for me that directly got me my job in Frankfurt. So there was no real in-between steps. Of course you have to then prove that you're doing a good job and that you're competent, and you know. And it's not to necessarily say that everyone will walk into a job, but I think it's an excellent start. And you'll learn the German system, which is completely different to the British system. The way the houses run, the way the rehearsals are run, the way the technical schedule is run. The language, of course, is completely different. So I would say coming in as an observer, you could do that depending on what your financial situation is like. You could do that more than once. If you want to do it on a compressed time scale, come in for a revival, 2.5 weeks, you'll be done. Mm-hmm. So I would say combine that with doing a language course. Being an observer, that would be my first sort of top tips to start, or else get yourself an excellent agent who has brilliant contacts. I don't have those things, but I think that would be a great start. There's a fantastic site called Bühnenjobs here in Germany, and you can sometimes see these positions advertised, but I would say just cold call, because not every production will have a hospitante. In fact, they rarely do. We're always like really excited and relieved if we discover that we have an observer on our team, or a hospitante or hospitantin. So I would say be bold, ask for what you want, ask to observe the director you want to observe, the time scale that you want, be really specific, and asking is free. Write in German.
Very cool.
That too.
You're a woman director. Do you think the differences between women directors and men directors, and how did you experience it in your experience?
That's a great question. I think sometimes there can be differences and sometimes there can't. I've known very strong, very forthright female and male directors, and I've known much more collaborative male and female directors as well. I think you often find yourself as a woman feeling like you have to prove yourself in the rehearsal room and feeling like you have to push a little bit harder to get your opinion heard, or you have to fight a little bit harder perhaps with the administration to get your thoughts across and your wishes and your wants. And I think often people aren't necessarily used to a woman standing up for what she needs and for what she believes in a way that if a man says the same thing, it, you know, suddenly things will begin to happen. So I think as a woman, I feel, I can't speak for all women, of course, but I feel we have to fight a little bit harder to make ourselves heard. And I think that comes from us. I think we as women, or sort of myself, me as a woman, you know, there's this word entitlement, and I think it's, we're not used to always having our voices heard. And I think that's something that we need to get used to and we need to push forward for. And it's not always natural for us to push ourselves forward and our ideas forward. So I think for women in the opera world, you sometimes feel you have to like push a bit harder or shout a bit louder or become the person that perhaps you aren't naturally enable you to have your voice heard within a world which unfortunately is very used to hearing a male voice. So I think we have to work harder. I mean, I hope it's not always the case, and I hope it's that people will listen regardless of who that voice is. And, you know, of course, what it is that you're saying is relevant, and you need to be saying something relevant and interesting and worth arguing for or fighting for, or ideas worth presenting. But I've seen in rehearsal rooms where I've assisted or where I've directed, where people can find it very easy to cut a woman down, and sometimes as a woman it's very easy to be cut down. So I think practicing and getting your voice heard and in feeling comfortable that you have a right to speak in the rehearsal room, in the home, everywhere, it's important for us as women. So I think for now we have to work a little bit harder so people are more used to hearing female voices in the rehearsal room, in the opera house, in the management. It's a real sadness to me that any day of the year you can walk into an opera house anywhere in the world and you can see an opera that's directed by a man, composed by a man, probably conducted by a man. You know, you can walk into any, many, many, many opera houses. And I think we just have to keep stepping forwards and getting our voices heard in that world. And, you know, if there's a day where I can walk into a house, and I hope maybe it's already today, that you can go in and you see an opera that's composed by a woman, that's also directed by a woman, that's perhaps also conducted by a woman, you know, it's, When has that happened? I've not seen one of those operas in my life ever. Mm. And I would love to.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, that what you are telling me, I also heard that, especially with a women conductor, you already mentioned them too. I mean, I already had two in my podcast, and they also said they have to be a little bit stronger in those leading positions. And they also have the quality that they also think they're more collaborative, and sometimes when they are very friendly and collaborative, that even sometimes like the intendant said to them, well, you have to be more strong, and they're like, no, but that's me, and I want to treat the people like that. And so I find that very interesting, because I really think, I mean, I'm a woman myself, that we also have very great qualities, and I think it's great if we can bring them into whatever workplace we are at, and that, yeah, eventually we have a place that those good male qualities and female qualities are equal and
really equally celebrated,
can really enrich whatever we do. So when you come in as a young director, and I mean, I assume sometimes you also probably have maybe very experienced or even famous singers. How is that? I mean, I'm sure they're probably also both, that singers are very respectful and happy to work with you, but maybe, I don't know, if there are also sometimes people who are like, she's too young and I know everything.
Yeah, I mean, I have experienced that. I think it flatters me to call me still a young director, but you can experience that, and I think the only things you can do against that is be incredibly well prepared and know exactly what you're there for, know the purposes of what you're doing. You know, if, for instance, mostly those instances when I've had to be in that position is if I'm reviving a fairly sort of high status show in a fairly high status house, or working on the revival or preparing it before, you know, the revival director arrives, and I think to be incredibly well prepared, to know exactly what needs to happen at any given time. So it turns out that everything you're suggesting is an excellent idea. I think you need to be able to, you know, ideally also you're able to speak in the same language as that person, so they're not able to dismiss you by lack of language. So I think being exceptional at your job is perhaps the only way you can get over people like that. And at the end of the day, you know, if it's something like directing a revival, or presumably also directing your own huge scale piece with well-known names, is where perhaps the hierarchy is a bit different, and then you do have a bit more status in the game. But I think to get to know them, to make them like you, which is, of course, again, another female trait, because I think people will accept more from someone that they like. And at the end of the day, they also need you. They need you to help negotiate them around this stage, and what their feelings are, what their intentions are, what the interactions are going to be. So it can be difficult. And I think, I don't only speak for myself, but we've all been, or I've certainly been, in a rehearsal room where you can just see this sort of sweeping dismissal in someone's eyes, where you realise that someone's just made a decision about you, and there's almost nothing you can do about it. And I think in that instance, just being incredibly well prepared and just doing your job incredibly well is the only thing that you can. And then over time, you prove yourself. But it's a tough world, and you have to be good.
That sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
I've seen a very interesting opera production years ago. I was studying at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and I went to the Dallas Opera a lot. We got tickets for that. And there was one production I will never forget. And it was not even a young director, but it was, I mean, the States are quite conservative in their productions, and they had a more like modern director. And this director, it was Elektra.
Mm-hmm.
I have then seen the production, which was very unique, but since the music is so great, I didn't care. But what happened was, there was this very modern director, and he kind of decided to put the whole Elektra story in like a Nazi camp.
Wow.
And he also had then the outfits for that, and a lot of uniforms. And they had a Elektra who was some whatever, I didn't know her, but whatever, she was some big known diva in the States.
Uh-huh.
And when she showed up to the rehearsals, she was shocked, and she was really like, I'm not going to do this. And she went up to the intendant, and she's like, either he or me, I'm not doing this.
Wow. And which way did they go?
They actually went with a singer.
No.
Yes. But the interesting thing was, when I saw the production, and that was the picture I will never forget, half of the stage, because I think they had then a little bit of time left, but not a lot. Half of the stage was the camp, the Nazi camp, but then they put like a Greek, the hat.
Uh-huh. Like a mask, a Greek mask?
Yeah, something like that. They put that in the front, so that was more like Greek mythology thing.
Yeah.
And the women, they had like kind of old-fashioned dress, and the men all had those uniforms. So you had a concept that didn't work at all anymore because you had the leftovers of the modern production and then the whatever other elements that the soprano
and says. A new director, so they'd sacked that director.
Yes,
and
somebody else kind of finished it up, and it was the weirdest production I've ever seen because nothing fit.
Yeah.
And then I often just closed my eyes because, I mean, the music was great, the singing was great. Yeah. But it was really weird.
Yeah, that sounds peculiar. I think they should have kept their original concept. I mean, it sounds fascinating.
Yes, but I don't know. I guess, soprano won.
Yeah, I guess the director was more fireable in that instance.
Obviously, yeah.
Unfortunately. I mean, that would have cost them a lot of money, I guess, either way.
Probably. No, sure.
Because you would have to fire the whole team, not just the... Well,
I don't know how they really worked it out. I mean, we kind of... It was like a big story then in Dallas, so we already knew before we went into the show that something weird would happen on stage. but we didn't know what the result would be, and then we were like, okay, it's like two production in one or something. Yeah. So now we want to talk about time management. You do lots of great things during the day. Lots of different things. And how do you do that? And is there any advice you would give to us?
Well, I have to say that I found Germany extraordinary in the way they run their rehearsals because, so in the UK, we have a very, what I would call a very, now I will say that one of the pros of working in the UK is we have a very civilized rehearsal schedule, and the standard rehearsal schedule is 10:30 till 1:30, 2:30 till 5:30, and then everyone gets their evenings off. And then once you're in the theatre, maybe it's slightly different. You might have stage and piano, stage and orchestras in the evening, and of course lighting rehearsals and so on and so forth. So what's completely different about Germany is that in Frankfurt, certainly, and in the other German houses I've worked in, we've always had morning and evening rehearsals. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you might be doing something like 10 to 1 and then 6 till 9 mm-hmm. or 5 till 8 or something like this. So it kind of throws your time management into a bit of a spin. I am getting used to it now. So this is my second season working in Oberfrankfurt. I think what we tend to get in Frankfurt is hopefully almost enough time to prepare for a revival, and then you're busy directing it, and then hopefully almost enough time to prepare for the next one, and then you're reviving it, and then sometimes you might get a gap in between, or maybe you can go away and do a job as a guest somewhere else. So you have to be quite careful with your time management. So I would spend the days when I'm preparing, I would, you know, you have to, so these are generally the productions that I've revived have not so far been productions that I worked on the first time, so I have to learn them from scratch. So I'm probably grappling with one or two regiebuchs, so the director's books, and then maybe one or two DVD versions, maybe a more detailed version, and then maybe a more sort of wide shot. So I would create a whole new regiebuch, and I would do all the complete blocking in my own words, because what I don't want to be doing when I'm running a revival rehearsal is like spinning through trying to translate German stage directions written in terrible handwriting.
When you do this preparation, but then you kind of have the day off. I mean, you don't have to do it between the two rehearsals.
Hopefully not. Yeah. Okay. So you would hope in the planning, it sometimes works out well, it sometimes works out terribly. You'd hope in the planning that you would get, I would hope for at least, you know, a couple of weeks to be able to do it in great detail. You know, some things take more than others. I did a huge revival before the summer of Damnation de Faust at Frankfurt, and that I needed to start preparing months in advance because it was so complicated and I was doing it completely alone. And it had choreography and it had huge different scenes and actors and, of course, all the chorus on the stage almost all the time and that kind of thing. Some things are more relatively straightforward. So this revival of Krennic's Drei Kurzopern that I've just opened at Opera Frankfurt, it was much more straightforward, so it would take me a lot less time. And of course, but then you also have to, you know, ideally have an excellent translation of it if you don't understand every single word. So I would hope to, you know, spend time on the translation, spend time making my book perfect so I could completely understand every single move and every single motivation for what's going on. I would hope to do that at least for a couple of weeks before starting a rehearsal. You know, it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes you have to cram. I think there were some times last year I had just a week and you have to really, really, you know, push it and do it 11-hour days or really work through. And then you might have a rest in between where you're able to kind of recover and then get ready for the next round. But I think what's different about working in Germany is that you're often... you're often alone. So in London or in the UK in general, even if you were a revival director, you would always have an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe just one because it's a revival, but you would always have an assistant. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Germany, you don't.
Okay.
And in Germany, also in the rehearsal room, you don't have a stage manager, which you would always have in the UK.
Oh, okay.
So in the houses that I've so far worked in, so maybe you would have, you know, someone from props might set up before the rehearsal or sort it out after the rehearsal. But in the rehearsal room, you're by yourself. So you're not only kind of, in a way, you have to prepare in many more layers because you're not just thinking about the director's job, you're thinking about actually what would the stage manager have to be doing, how will the props be, so you need to have a much deeper understanding because you're not necessarily going to walk in there and everything's going to be ready. You might have to set things up yourself. So it takes a kind of level of detail that perhaps we might not have to have in the UK, just in terms of you're doing the equivalent of maybe five people's jobs.
You have
jobs
to have a great overview. I mean, that sounds like incredible.
Yeah. And for instance, like in the German houses, I would have to queue on the singers. You know, if they don't know their cues already, you would have to be queuing them on, which would always in the UK be done by stage management. So in your score, you're looking for all the different elements, the entrances, the scene changes, all the aspects of what happens with props on stage, so everything to detail because there's going to be nobody doing that for you. So I mean, I'm not really talking about time management anymore, I'm just sort of talking about the complexities of
it. But that's also very interesting.
But it just means you have to cram a lot in those preparation weeks. You really have to cram a lot in, and then sometimes you just need to take some time out to recover from it. So just in the last days since we opened Krenegg on Friday, and then I just completely took the whole weekend off and just took some downtime because
great.
Yeah, I think you have to. I had a bit of a struggle before the summer after when I was opening the Damnation, where I, you know, physically it was just too much. So now I just have to make sure I get at least one clear day off a week and just to be really careful with your time because, you know, our bodies also have their boundaries and they will tell us.
Yes, that's very important. What are you thankful for today?
I'm thankful for being able to do a job that I love and to work with incredible artists. I'm thankful for being able to work in a language that's not my own. I think it's a great, great privilege to have the resources and the ability to be able to learn a new language and communicate in a new language. So I'm very, very thankful for that.
Who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you and what inspires you?
I think the greatest role in shaping me, I would have to say, going to school in Wales, there's an incredible musicality about it, and there's music in your everyday life. I think I mentioned this right at the beginning, but I think it just somehow is then always in your blood because it's always there. You're used to it every day. We would sing in assembly and we would have these competitions, these Eisteddfods, and you're singing as a group and you're singing as an individual and you're singing in a choir and you're on stage and you're here and you're there and you're in a musical and you're this and that and the other. And I think that is something that, I mean, I guess Wales is known for it, but I think that's something that really meant music was somehow in my heart. My father's also a musician, but I think that growing up around music all the time is something that definitely stayed with me, even though, you know, I went on to study theatre first of all, was sort of the music that came back. And I suppose for me, you know, part of what I do is being able to move people, because I think that's what music can really do. You know, we can really move people by what they see and what they hear in the world of opera, in the world of music, in the world of drama, and if I'm able to move people with music, then I guess I'm happy.
Well, it's great that you have yourself such an understanding of music. I'm not sure if all opera directors have that. I mean, I'm not sure if all opera director could give the entrances, like, if you can do that. I mean, sounds like you're very able and
the
very
terrible
musical
role of the assistant director or the revival director.
What does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in this music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
I think by being true to myself and my personality and in the work that I do and presenting myself, even though I was talking earlier about sometimes having to just push yourself a little bit further or to speak a little bit louder, or you have the feeling that you have to always bring your true self into everything that you're doing and to share that true self with other people. I think that for me would be my way of being authentic. And I think I try not to, you know, I'm probably a terrible sort of networker and that sort of thing, but I think to be truly yourself, you will then gain real friends and real colleagues and you know, real relationships, and create real relationships on the stage. And I think you can only really create that truth by being your very true self. And I hope that's what I would bring, and that would, you know, be my authenticity card to play.
Wonderful. What does success mean for you?
To be honest, I don't know yet what success would look like for me. I definitely feel like I haven't got there yet, whatever this, you know, elusive success feeling is. I do feel very lucky that I'm able to work with the people that I work with, and I'm able to work with the musicians that I work with, the singers that I work with, that I'm able to work in this incredible craft of opera and theatre. And I'm not yet certain what success is like, but perhaps that's because I haven't met it yet.
Very interesting answer. What drives you forward, and do you have a vision?
I think I always have the hunger to create work and to create new work. I think I always have a desire to work with people and to work with, to be surrounded by friends and colleagues and to bring ideas forward together. So I think that definitely drives me, is the feeling of working together as a group and to having a common goal. I would say vision. I tend to have visions when in sort of specific productions. So mm-hmm. I would pull a vision together for a new production or that I was developing with a set designer and a costume designer. So in that instance, I would say I have a vision on a sort of per show basis, or sometimes I often get sort of inspired visually by art exhibitions and in museums, just by shapes and visuals. And visions, I would say I get to do with particular shows and particular operas and particular pieces I would develop. I would say I don't have sort of an overall vision for life or answers for life. I wish I did. And you have to tell me if you have one you can share with me.
I heard a vision you have. I mean, we talked about it, that we wish that there will be, how did you say? You want to walk into the opera house?
Yes, that's true.
With a production, with a woman composer, a woman conductor, and a woman director. I mean, so I think
that would be my vision, for sure.
A great vision.
Let's
too.
Get back to that vision. That's a much better answer.
But vision can be anything.
I like that. So that's a good one to go back to. Let's keep it.
Yeah, we are actually at the last question. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know from you, which tip would you like to give young artists? Or I say it differently, is there a tip you would have wished that, or you would like to give your younger self, maybe the one?
So many. Oh, God. Well, a young artist one is a good one, because I've worked on a lot of productions with young artists, young singers back in the UK and now also here in Germany since the summer. And so I would say, well, I can't speak for every opera house, of course, but I once received from a singer an 11-page CV, and it included the details of every single side job that he had had since he was like maybe 12 years old or something like this. It was 11 pages, and this was a small company I was working for in the UK, and I was having to print out the CVs of these. So I used to spend, when I was looking at these CVs and we were deciding who we were going to audition and not audition, I was having to trim down their CVs because I didn't want to spend all of my mm-hmm. printer stuff on an 11-page CV of a young artist. I didn't even have a double-sided printer. So I would say my advice to young artists would to be, keep your CV nice and short, maximum 2 pages.
Great advice.
So that's my number one tip. I would say when I'm receiving messages from young directors or young singers, I think keep it short, get to the point. It's so much easier to answer an email that's very short and sweet than it is. If someone sends a long time sending a really deep and meaningful email, it's just you feel like you don't have time to reply. Whereas if someone fires you a quick email and you can respond quickly, it's so much easier. So I would say keep it short and sweet. Don't be shy about writing more than once. I know that can be different for singers, because I know people often, you know, casting directors and things feel hassled by singers attacking them all the time. I would say going back what would I have done? I would have, it's ironic seeing my position is now a staff director, but I would have assisted less in my earlier days and done and pushed to do more of my own work. And it's an incredibly difficult system if you're working in that assistant directing and directing, because directing often at a small scale isn't bringing in very much money. So the assisting is what brings your income in and makes you able to pay your rent or whatever, if you're not lucky enough to have parents that can afford a flat or whatever. So I think it can be easy if you're a good assistant director to be caught on a cycle of it and you don't break out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably, you know, it would have been much more helpful to me to have broken out of it a bit sooner and to push and develop more of my own work. You know, I wasn't financially independent enough to do that, but I think, you know, that would have been a wish at that point, just to keep pushing to do more of your own work as early as possible. And if you don't want to be a career assistant director, don't try not to get caught in that loop, even though it's very difficult, and keep pushing to do that work on the side. Or, you know, often I was assisting and then directing shows at weekends and between rehearsals and after rehearsals and all that kind of thing. So do push to have your very own output. I think it's can be feel like a bit of a sharp piece of advice, but the other thing I would say is that look out for yourself, because often if you're working perhaps for a company that you've been very loyal to for a long time, they're not necessarily going to give back to you. You're one of many assistants. Mm-hmm. So be careful of your own journey and what you choose for yourself, because nobody's looking after your career for you. And, you know, unless hopefully you've got a nice agent, in which case fantastic. But look after yourself, look after where you're going, be very clear about what you want. Asking is always free, and don't be afraid of asking for what you want. These are all things that I did not do and which I wish I had done as a younger director. So I think stay on your path. Hugely important, not to compare yourselves to other people. At your age, at the, you know, younger than you, older than you, how well people are doing, which houses they're working in, which languages they're speaking, you are on your own path, and the best thing is to try. I mean, I think it can be really helpful and really interesting to know what other people are doing and thinking, actually, you know, if you feel strongly about a person doing something, why is it you feel strongly about that? And would you like to be doing something like that? In which case, do something about doing something like that. Don't just sort of curdle in your feelings of anxiety about people doing better than you. It's absolutely crippling. I think as an artist, don't do it to yourself. We've all been there, I'm sure. But look out for yourself, look after yourself. And also my final thing might be to try to do something outside this world that keeps it in perspective. So I think in this day and age of Instagram and Twitter and self-promotion, we all, to a certain extent, most of us participate in it or have a role in it. And I think we can actually become quite self-absorbed and self-obsessed, and the roles that we're playing, you know, whether that's director, whatever role you're playing in a production, how important the production is, how whatever the status is. And I think try to have something else in your life that puts things in perspective. It is, at the end of the day, it's only opera, as a dear stage manager once used to say, when you know everything was in a sort of catastrophic state. Mm-hmm. It's only opera. And just to remind you, so if there's something you can do outside of opera that's looking to the outside world and thinking about other people and not having that sort of terribly inward look that we seem to need to have in this day and age, I would say just to keep life in perspective.
Well, thank you very much. Those are great tips. And also that you gave us so much insight actually about the directing world and directing path. I'm sure that people who also want to go into this profession can take a lot out of it. And obviously other things are also relevant to everybody. And I thank you so much that you have been here to my place in Düsseldorf and that you have been so open to us, and I wish you all the luck with all your upcoming productions. And I will, as always, put all the informations about you and your website into the show notes. And big thank you to you.
Thank you so much. It was my great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This was the interview with Nina Braser, and I really hope that there was a lot for you in it, that it inspired you. And I welcome you to write to me through email or Facebook. I'm very thankful that you tuned in today with me, and I would love it if you could tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I say thank you. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.